Hi, I'm Sarah Karakayan.
I'm Annette Grant, and together we are
Thanks for visiting.
And this is Success Unlocked Season 1. Let us explain.
So our mission here at Thanks for Visiting is to unite and equip short-term rental hosts to create unique and safe spaces-turned businesses, to strengthen guest and community trust so we can ensure the longevity and profitability of independent hosts. And of course, to bring more host voices to the forefront.
It's one thing to hear our perspective on short-term rental business building strategies, but we wanted to bring more value to you by introducing other incredible hosts to the Thanks for Visiting stage.
So we are excited to present to you this season of Success Unlocked, where our Hosting Business Mastery Membership coaches will discuss operations, social media, unique builds, co-hosting strategies, and so much more.
Today's show, The System Shakedown, is hosted by Wendy Doris. She owns a highly sought-after property management company in Scottsdale, Arizona. With 10-plus years of experience in the short-term rental space, Wendy has had tremendous amount of success in establishing efficient systems.
She has created seamless operations to allow her the opportunity to focus on increasing revenue and profits. Specifically, Wendy has perfected the design of her listings. And this isn't limited to physical design in the space. She has studied listing design to optimize booking results, and she is obsessed with the process. Let's get to today's episode.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back. This is Wendy, and I am here with Jeff Metzger, who you probably don't know who he is because he is not in the STR space, but he is my stepdad. And he is going to provide some background about private lending, specifically with your family, which is something that people do not talk about. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the show.
Wendy, how are you? Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming. I know this is a little bit weird because you're not in the STR space. You probably don't even know what STR means. It's short-term rentals. But can you give a little background about yourself and your business and tell people about yourself?
Well, you want the non-resume version here, the real-life version?
Yep.
I'm a college dropout. He's never had a business course in his life except Accounting 101. I dropped out of college to follow my hobby. So I found out I love teaching kids. So I tell people I dropped out of college to teach cartwheels to kids, which is, in fact, the truth. And so I did that and started a small operation when I was 23. Did enough of the right things. That operation grew to where we moved to a bigger location and then another and another. We're now in our 11th iteration of growth. Our business is called Kids First Sports Center and has a myriad of, it's a children's instructional service, a myriad of sports activities and educational agile activities for kids. We're located in Cincinnati, Ohio. We are with probably the biggest in the nation. We have 184,000 square feet. We sit on 15 and a half acres, and we serve probably in the neighborhood of 5,000 children a week. So if you want to take a look to learn a little more, you'd want to go to Kids First Sports Center. You won't learn a lot about me, but you'd learn a lot about Kids First. KidsFirstSports.com, by the way.
Yes, and it first started out as gymnastics. I think the biggest gym in the world, possibly.
From a square footage standpoint and from other metrics, very possibly. Hard to quantify.
Yeah, it's hard to tell. But
we'll find that until somebody says otherwise.
That's right. That's right. And I was a gymnast at Kids First. I grew up there and Jeff became my stepdad throughout the process. And so I did want to explain our relationship because this is about lending to family, which is tricky. So while we are family, when you started lending to me for my flips, it was new in the relationship. You had just married my mom. And so asking you for money was tricky for me. I don't know if you know that, but I knew you had money. So I was like, all right, I know this can get it done, but how am I going to ask him? I was nervous. I thought maybe that it would be rude to ask you. And I think that you and mom had been married for a few years, but I was away at college and then came home. And that's when I started the flipping business. So the first deal that we did together was a flip. I actually did a mortgage. I put a mortgage on the property with just a typical bank mortgage and then borrowed the renovation money from you. And I think it was $16,000. So right now, like thinking of how big renovations can get and can cost now 16,000 is pennies. But and that was in 2006. So I think looking back, that was a good way to start, because even though our relationship was new, it was a small amount compared to borrowing hundreds of thousands of dollars. Do you remember me asking you to borrow money?
Not specifically. When you made the mention that you were nervous, that brought back a bit of a memory that there was some nervousness, but I couldn't have told you that now.
I can only imagine the phone call. Hi, do you think I can borrow some money? And I don't even know how I asked, but that was the first deal. And then it grew from there. I flipped houses for 16 years and you were a big part of that. So thank you. I think that a lot of times people are nervous to borrow from family because of what can go wrong, right? Or the warnings that a lot of people give, borrowing money from your family. So one of the things I think I learned this from you, but it got better over the years, was presenting a plan, showing you the numbers, that I had thought through everything. So I think when you're borrowing from family, you can definitely be like, do you want to do this with me? And it's very informal, which it can be. But if you want to get somebody to say yes, present a plan. Do you remember any of this happening between us?
Not specifically. No, I can't say that I do. I'll jump in here a little bit. And when you, some 3 or 4 weeks ago, when you forwarded the idea about me helping out on a podcast about lending to family and the uniquenesses or the pitfalls, I remember thinking, and we had a conversation following this thought, that it was a little, I don't mean to say stunned. And so here's the point. What's the difference? To me, there's not much difference between lending to family or lending to a non-family member. I would not consider lending to a family member who hadn't displayed good financial management in general and had a plan for the project that could be presented. And so to me, I would not lend to a family member without those things being in place, just like I would not lend to a non-family member without those items being in place, the more important of them being integrity and financial management, because with that, even a plan, when a plan goes wrong, if there's integrity, you can then recoup those losses in some manner or another, because integrity means that someone will then fall through on their obligation. So no, I don't remember specifically you asking. I can imagine, I'm thinking, I could see where you would be nervous, but it's not a recollection that I have now.
Because our relationship is a little bit different than a parent that I've been grew up with, I can imagine with some people, and I've heard this from friends with like their spouses or their family members, that they kind of just throw the idea out to just see if that person's going to bite instead of coming to them with a plan. So I knew that you were a business person. We had talked about business. I was working in your business. So I knew I better come with it, come with the plan, show the numbers.
We'd had many business conversations up to that point. So I think you had an intuitive sense that was a smart way to approach that. I'm here on a podcast and your mom's here.
Hi, Mom.
How are you?
Hi. Speaking of Mom, let's talk about, was she ever involved in the decision process? Because I was thinking about this. There were times when I was like, you know, the house that I'm flipping, and I would be talking to you about it, and she would have no idea what we're talking about. And then I was thinking about it, like, I don't think Dusty was involved in the process. I think because it was my own business, he's not involved in it. And we just didn't discuss it. I was buying houses all the time and selling houses all the time. So he's whatever, another house. But you and I came to this decision together. Sometimes she had no idea what was going on.
That's fairly accurate. I don't think either you nor I are advocating that we don't talk with our spouses about it. But I've been in business a long time and have done countless business deals before Penny and I ever got married. So when it came time to just doing another business deal of this size, that was just because of the nature of our relationship and how it developed. So no, we didn't have long discussions about that. Is it a good idea? Is it not a good idea? I certainly, in some instances or many instances, would ask her opinion there. But I don't, in this case, I don't remember whether I did or not. On the other hand, that's a unique situation. So it's not, if I were advising someone that didn't have a unique situation like that, I think it would be good, sound advice to have those discussions with your spouse. But just like you said, you've done many business deals. Dusty trusted you in your decision about the houses you were buying. And this is just one more. Same on our end. This is just one more in a relatively small business deal.
True. And I will say that eventually along the way through the years, I did do private lending with my dad and my stepmom and with Dusty's parents. So those were completely different situations. Those decisions were made with everybody involved because they're different people and the situation was different. In some cases, like Dusty's mom, my mother-in-law, she helped me in the business. So she was very much involved. And then his dad was more of the money part. But in our situation, you wanted to be very hands-off. So this is something that I would recommend to the listeners. Work this out beforehand. What's the relationship going to be like after the money's in play, right? So how involved does your private lender, your family member want to be? What kind of decisions will they be making? What kind of decisions will they not be able to make? So for instance, we didn't have conversations about how the house was going over dinner. Sometimes it would come up, but most often not. And you said from the beginning, you like, just leave me out of it, basically. I don't have time to, I trust your judgment, go for it.
Well, I don't have any expertise in the area. If I had expertise, obviously I didn't even know the initials of the field that we're talking about. So I had no expertise in the area. So for me to say I need to be involved in decisions would really muddle things up and hamper your decisions. What I needed to feel comfortable with is that you had a handle on your decisions and that you had a plan that had reasonable chance of success. So that's what I'm going in judging. I'm not judging. I'm not looking at any of the specifics of the decisions you're making. But do you have a handle on this project and the ability to see it through successfully so that I can recoup my investment and that you can make some money along the way? So that's just, for me, that's second nature in business. That's akin to delegating. You delegate responsibilities and authority to make decisions. And this is a case where you had 100% of the authority to make all those decisions there. I had none, didn't want any because I didn't have anything to contribute.
And we agreed on it very early on. In fact, one of the things we agreed on was the setup of the mortgage. We had one. Maybe in the beginning, I'm not sure if we did, but eventually I remember you specifically saying to me, we need to file a mortgage with the county in case you get hit by a bus. And I laugh about that every time because, well, it's funny, but it's true. You need to have your documents in place and in case something happens. If that's something that you had mentioned up front, instead of just lending the money to me and it being a private and without having the mortgage recorded with the county. But it's important to have those things in place to protect each other.
Absolutely. And it really is more so not because the person may lack integrity, which, by the way, is obviously a huge problem, but it's because that the unforeseen happens. And I don't remember mentioning to you in case you get hit by a bus. On the other hand, in our company, everyone, that's actually one of our 11 responsibilities of our department leaders is to have what we call a bus plan. And that is how does your component of the business continue? What's your plan for the continuation of your department if you get hit by a bus on the way to work? So having a bus plan is just second nature thinking to me. And so obviously I shared that with you at that time. But it's an important piece of the pie for any family members who are considering making loans to other family members is what does happen if that person becomes unable to see the project through. How is that? How are you going to then be made whole, recoup your money on that? So, you know, having a mortgage on the property was one piece of it. I'll give you another thought. By the way, just so you know, Wendy, I had zero experience in this area of hard money lending. I had never heard the term until you brought it to the table in what you just reminded me was 2006. So you taught me something there. So I do hard money loans, not to others. I've only done hard money loans with you and the lady, Jennifer, who is now the president of Kids First Sports Center when I retired in 2020. So she is the president of Kids First Sports Center, and she flips houses with her husband, and they work. So when we started, same requirements as Jennifer, that there be a mortgage recorded. and the numbers are larger now, and the size of the hard money loan is probably averaging somewhere 150, 175 with Jennifer now, and she's borrowing for the house and the rehab and the rehab. Well, once we got two or three houses and this and my exposure became greater, we put another requirement in there. So not only do each of the houses have to have a mortgage recorded, but also I asked for a life insurance policy on Jennifer, where she is then assigns to me that life insurance policy. And an assignment means it's for the value of any obligations that she may have to me, that life insurance policy then would cover that obligation. So once it got past the more significant exposure for me, I felt I needed to add that additional exposure. Now, my lending, just so everybody, you know, for the sake of the lenders, the lending requirements I have with Jennifer would be no different than with a family member. I mean, I treat Jennifer the same as I would a family member in terms of protection and all of the the terms of the loan there. So it's all very businesslike. So when you said, would you loan me money? I'm sure I said, after looking at the plan, let me see your plan. I'm sure I said, sure. I said, but I need protection. Let's get a mortgage in place. And we will write a note, expressing the terms of the note and the repayment terms, the interest rate, so that everybody's in full understanding. So to you listeners, lending to family, if there are any differences, there are not many. There are a lot more similar. It's no different than lending to a third party, a non-family member. So, I mean, and now I look at Jennifer, I have the same, if you will, confidence in Jennifer and her integrity that I do in you. And I think by this point in the podcast, everybody should begin to assume that or understand that that's got to be there first, or I'm not even going to consider if I have a family member or a friend, or in this case, Jennifer was an employee, if she's still an employee, but now actually she is my supervisor now. But it's the same requirement, and those requirements are integrity, good money management, and do you have a plan? Any of those aren't there, it's just a no-go deal, whether it's a family member or a non-family member.
Let's talk about the part of the plan that nobody wants to talk about is what if somebody loses money on the deal? And I know we've been talking about flips, but this is for any real estate deal, especially. We'll get to STRs in a second, but we have written in our contract, I think we had a joint venture contract at the time. What happens if we lose money? Because you're going to get 5 stars for a while and you're going to get your first 4-star. You're going to lose money at some point, maybe. Hopefully not, but probably. So we did have that written into the contract.
So who has the risk? Who bears the risk? And I'll be honest, I can't remember. So what was covenant or what was the agreement there about you losing money?
If we lose money, you lose money. No, well, we had it structured different ways depending on the deal, but the risk was on your side because my risk as the borrower was I worked for free or, I worked and got nothing out of it, if that makes sense. I used my time, you used your money. So that was the way I think we had it structured. By the way, suggested by your son, the lawyer, in our contract.
Not involved there. Okay.
Yeah. But it doesn't really, the specifics of that and how we did it doesn't necessarily, it's not as important as how you work it out. Because every family, private money, lending deal is going to be different. Because there might be somebody that the family, maybe the parent and the child are working together and they structure the deal differently. So it just depends. I mean, like doing the labor.
More of a partner where the reward is shared and then the risk. So in concept, if the reward is going to be shared, if there's some partnership agreement where the reward of the project is going to be shared between the borrower and the lender, then in concept, then the risk would be shared. If all of the reward is going to go to the borrower and the person driving the project, then we're talking more of a conventional loan with an interest rate, in which case then the lender would not have any risk there. And so all the risk would be borne by the borrower, who then in some cases would lose money, but that interest would be due nonetheless. So conceptually, that's the way most business deals would be structured.
Correct. Here. Actually, we did end up changing towards the end of the run, where instead of we split the profit or you took the loss in the of the which we really didn't have much. It was maybe like $1,000 or something.
You're reminding me about a structure that I had forgotten about because we went to a hard money loan bearing an interest rate as we moved.
Yeah. And the reason was because that was stressful for me to be stressed about you losing money was too much. So then we changed to interest. And so I would pay you just like I would pay a bank monthly. In fact, you said you could pay me at the end. And I didn't want to do that because I wanted to have the pressure of the monthly payment. And actually, so if you're doing private lending for a short-term rental, which we did at the one of our last deals that we did was a short-term rental. I bought my very first deal, my very first short-term rental in Phoenix. It was a condo. So you provided the funds for the purchase and the renovation. And then the idea was that we would, so I refinance out and you would get everything back. And the process would take 6 months, which I want to talk about that in a second. But one of the things, like I wanted to have those payments that I was making to you every month as a timeline for myself, like another payment.
Your own discipline, not for your own discipline.
Right, right. Like it, like, oh my God, another payment. Like that to me, otherwise, because we had done it another way where you just pay me the interest at the end and you just don't have like, you know, that discipline, or maybe you forget, like time's flying when renovation problems are coming up. When you feel that pressure of that payment, you start to step on the gas with contractors and that sort of thing. I was going to say one thing I wanted to talk about with that deal was that it was supposed to be 6 months. Always at the beginning of every new loan, which by the way, we always complete. It's not an ongoing, like we're not just passing money around here. Like there's a start and end. That one was supposed to be 6 months. So I was supposed to renovate and start getting the refinance the house within 6 months. Well, I was having issues with a bank and I can't remember why, but the refi kept pushing and I think it went to 12 months. And I remember at the time I was feeling pressure, but you were also reminding me like, hey, there's a timeline for these funds. Because you're allocating them to the next investment that you had. That's something that we are sure to talk before we do a deal. Okay, when do you need these funds? How much do you have available? Which can help the borrower figure out how to structure the deal. Are we going to use the whole thing for purchase? Is it just for renovation? Is it just to furnish the house? Whatever it is. And then the timeline of when the funds need to be back in hand. Which may be never, depending on the situation. But, I mean, not never, but when you sell the short-term rental years from now, but
the majority of your listeners here are probably looking to buy, fix up, own, and then rent. Is that pretty much the model there?
Yes. Okay. Yes. But that doesn't mean that the private lender has to weather the entire storm, right? Like we did, borrow it, refi, and then move on. But so you could get your funds back in 6 months, 12 months, whatever the timeline was. There might be a situation, and ours has never worked out this way, but there might be a situation where somebody is going to put furnishing budget in, the down payment, whatever it is, as part of their partnership. And then they're partnering on that deal, on that home as a short-term rental, as the investment.
Got it. Yeah.
Yeah. So we haven't done that, but refinancing out is a way to move your private lender, take advantage of the private lender being able to move quickly for the purchase without the obstacle of a loan, and then just refinance out and they get their money back.
In your situation with most of your listeners, so here's a thought that, by the way, neat and clean is very important to me because when something gets complex, it takes time. That's important for me to any business arrangement. We want to make it as hassle-free and as automatic as possible so it doesn't take time managing it. So a thought would be if today you were saying, hey, listen, I've got my eye on a house. I want to buy a house. Fix it up, and I want to put it in your portfolio to rent. So if you can help me get to the point where then I can go to the bank and then refinance that house, the first thing I'm thinking of, nice, neat, and clean, would be to say, well, let's do a hard money loan. I'm throwing out ideas here. Okay, first thing I'm thinking of, let's do a hard money loan. You borrow for the cost of the house, the cost of plus the rehab, because I don't want to get into a situation where you're asking for draws, because now we're getting into a time. So you borrow the cost of the house, which is going to be $150,000. The estimated rehab is $50,000, a nice neat $200,000. So we will do that. And let's just say, and I don't have great experience in this. So I know, so for a family member, you know, we might do that, say, let's do that. We'll do a hard money loan for 10%. And that's going to be, so at the end of this project, with a balloon in a year. So in a year, then you've got to, how long is the rehab going to take? It's going to take 8-9 months. Okay, let's say a year. So you've got that money for a year. At the end of the year, then you've got a responsibility then to refinance that, mm-hmm. and then to make whole on the principal plus the $200,000 plus that interest there. And then what you might do as the lender, you might say, now, so especially if you're working with a family member or otherwise, what happens if the rehab takes longer, or if it takes a little bit longer to get the loan because of just banking the nonsense that you've got to go through? Say, okay, well, after a year, you know, a non-friendly lender might say, well, that gives me the right to call the loan. A more friendly lender might say, okay, well, it's not my goal really to have this money invested long term, but how about we'll do this? We'll do this a hard money loan for 10% for 1 year. And then after 1 year, then that ratchets up to, say, you know, 11% or 12%. Or maybe after another 6 months. So there's some penalty. So it puts a little bit of, you know, a little lights a fire under the borrower to make this happen as they offered it. So that's where would be a direction that one could go that would keep it nice and simple. Assuming the plan worked out, then everybody would made whole and happy at the end of the deal there.
Again, these are things that you want to talk out before you get started, and you might say,
oh, absolutely. And you don't only want to talk them out. You want to have it captured in a note.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
All the terms writing in notes. So it's got to be talked out, understood, and then captured. And I will talk about that for a moment. You want a contract. Now, if we're talking about family members, what's a one might say, well, why do you need a contract? Well, there's two reasons. One is so that we make sure we understand each other. So there's no misunderstanding, so that it's in writing. And here's what it says. So you want it because of the understanding aspect of it. Why else might one want a contract? And that is, well, if the other party doesn't follow through, I have legal recourse, and that's called a lawsuit, right? So now you go, say, well, wait a second, with a family member, am I really going to go to step two? Am I really going to? And the answer to that is probably not. And I'm not saying it should never happen. Maybe there's cases. So which really then takes us back to, well, why do we have a contract in the first place? With a family member, I probably pretty much assume I would not use it in a legal sense. But I still want that contract for that first reason. That is so that we understand each other. Because I would not take legal recourse against a family member, or unlikely that I would. But the understanding and the clarity that comes with capturing and writing is critical. So even that party, even that mom or dad who's going to lend money to their child or brother or sister, whatever the case may be, you want a contract because it's going to capture the understanding of it. It's an agreement, right? It's also a legal contract. Are we going to use it in a legal sense? Maybe never. And we know that, but we sure need that as an understanding, an agreement. And by the way, and having that contract is critical. It's important, but not nearly as important as knowing that you're dealing with somebody with integrity. Because what to take legal recourse on a contract, a broken contract, is very costly. There's no assurance that it's, and there's no assurance that even after the cost that you incur, that you're going to be made, you're going to recoup that money. So contract between a family member, I think of it less of a contract and more as an agreement. It's an understanding, because I know with a family member, I'm not going to take legal recourse.
Now, we've done a lot of deals and we can't really remember the specifics of it.
It's a vague memory to you. It's a vaguer memory to me. And you think, well, that's because it's been since 2006. And I don't tell you, then no, you can make an agreement today in June of 2023. And 9 months later, both parties won't have any idea what was said. It is amazing how confusing it can get. So an agreement, an understanding is critical. Whether you're going to look at it and consider it a legal contract, if the agreement is broken, that's up to the individual. That's up to the circumstance. I'll tell you a story. Being in the Children's Instructional Services, we started as a gymnastics school, but we also have swimming instruction and many other sports. I went to a swim school conference and I re-met. Her name was Greta. She was an old German lady who had kind of a stubborn attitude about life that kind of sets the stage a little bit. And she was not, and I'd known her from before. I didn't know her well, but I'd known her from previous meetups at previous conferences. She didn't have a lot of business acumen, if you will. So I kind of had that sense about her. And she was older. And so I met her. As a matter of fact, this was somewhere in Phoenix. I can only tell you that. And we met in the conference room. And she says, "Oh, Jeff," she says, I'm selling my business. I've got out from under." Okay. She's got an exit plan. She's got out from under. I'm selling my business to an employee. And his name was Joe. And, "Oh, that's wonderful." And she was quite excited. I guess she was feeling stresses of running a business and exiting was important to her. And "Oh, that's wonderful." And we start talking about life and things. And she started talking about somebody. It's describing a person that is kind of a self-sabotaging person, that didn't really have a lot of integrity. And I said, "Well, you said, hey, what's this guy's name?" She said, "Joe." I said, "Well, that's not the same Joe that you're selling your business to, is it?" She says, "Oh, yeah, yeah." I'm thinking, she's telling me, here's this guy, and she's going to be holding the paper, and I should have, she's going to be holding a note on this. And she's telling me about this guy who clearly, if you will, lacked integrity. And then this is the guy that she's given a loan to buy her business. I said, "This is the same guy?" She said, "Yeah." She said, "Oh, don't worry." He says, I got a good attorney. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, that's wrongheaded thinking. It's not the value of in a business relationship. The contract means this much. Okay. The integrity of the individual, that's what you're looking for. When you're going to give a loan to a family member or non-family member, it's the person's integrity, their habit of following through with what they say they're going to do, of keeping a promise, if you will. Integrity means to integrate what they do, what you do with your words, okay? So if I say this, I do this. So that's what integrity means. It's integrating your actions with your words. And so contracts are not tight. A tight contract is not how you go into a business relationship.
Well, you don't even want to get to that point where you have to fight it out.
Absolutely. I frankly have done many business arrangements with people who have integrity. Matter of fact, if I sense that, that'll make any difference what kind of reward there may be. But I've gone into many business relationships with very unlegal agreements. Now, the agreement is written very much in layman's terms, but if we understand each other, because I don't feel I even need the legalities of the contract as much as I do the understanding in the contract, because I'm dealing with somebody who has integrity. So I cannot overemphasize that with a family, because what happens if you lend to a family member who hasn't shown good money management skills? Not only do they have to be savvy, I mean, they have to have integrity with their money. They have to follow through with their word. Well, now you have that. What happens is that a party, let's say, does not have integrity, and they have shown in the past that they don't follow through with their word. And here, once again, you've loaned them money and they're not following through with their word. Now you've got the relationship issues that you've got to deal with there.
And then you're going to have the awkward part.
Exactly where you don't want to be. So if you're going to lend money to a family member, you lend money to a family member because they have integrity and because they have a plan.
I'm glad you brought this up with that employee, because I've been wanting to ask you for years about something that keeps coming up in my business. I shouldn't say keeps coming up. I'm reminded of it because I learned it from you working in the business. I feel like it's our gym, even though it's not, because I grew up there. I learned about from you, and I wonder if this has changed at all over the last decade since I learned it, about two percenters. Can you explain to everyone the concept of two percenters?
You know what? I'm going to let you jump in there because you mentioned that.
It clearly affected me. So two percenters, I used to coach at the gym, and two percenters were the 2% of the population who are just going to be unreasonable. They're just unreasonable people that there's no amount of logical thinking or explanation or anything like that's going to convince them otherwise, or just have a reasonable conversation. That's what I gathered from you. And then so I saw how you handled some unreasonable clients that were at the gym. And it's almost like cutting your losses. Like I can understand. And we have this with guests that come to our short-term rental Airbnbs, if you want to call it. We see this with owners who some of us co-host for. They're just going to be unreasonable, and it's not a good alignment with those clients and how to handle that. So is this ringing a bell to you? Because it was very important to me.
Oh, yeah, very, very, very much, very much. We have actually, our company, Kids First, is an open book company. We share all the data within other than each other's wages and salaries. So everything is very open. All the business, all the executive decisions about how the money is spent, that's all extremely open. And that our open book leadership strategy is grounded on an expression, reasonable. So you bring up the word reasonable. That's a pivotal word in our business. Reasonable people, given the same information, will come to the same conclusion. So what that means is that if we share information about how the inner workings of the business and how business is done, and if we have reasonable people, they will then look at that same information, be it data or otherwise, and then come to the same conclusion, even when the conclusions are not pleasant, or even when it leads to some decisions that are that we'd all rather not see, then we are likely then to come together on that. So you bring up unreasonable. There is some percentage of the population that you really, I don't care what business you're in, you really are better off not doing business with. Now, is that 2%? As you know, we can grab a hold of that.
Do you think the number to 10?
You know,
has the number changed?
There's an argument. I see the argument and I see the grin on your face and I understand what you're saying. And there'd be an argument to say maybe it has because the world has, in many instances and in many aspects, gone crazy. All right. It's like some of the things that we see as normal now, it boggles one's mind. But I would say for our company, the answer is no, it hasn't grown. And that is because that has to do with we speak and we focus very much on culture building in our company, as you know. And the better we have gotten, the better we have become at knowing who we are and knowing what culture we need to be dedicated to, and then have the courage to follow through to make sure we maintain that culture. As we get better and better at that, then the potential clients out there in the marketplace, those who are not aligned with our thinking aren't attracted to our business because we communicate who we are, what we believe in, why we do the things we do, and why we do them the way we do it. And so then what we do is we get our clients from a percentage standpoint, we have more clients who are aligned with our way of thinking because we're better at knowing who we are and then communicating who we are. And then those clients that are out there in that marketplace that don't really align with that thinking, they don't get involved in our program to begin with. So the world's gone crazy, and there are challenges today that we didn't have, you know, 2 years ago, 5 years ago, and 10 years ago. And so it's a valid question. Is it, are there more? You know, there's argument to say perhaps there are more. It's more, it's not 2% any longer, it's more. But the better we have gotten and knowing our business and establishing our culture internally and then communicating that to potential clients, the fewer problems, the less chance of that 2% becoming a 3%. And it's uncanny because we have multiple businesses. So it's not just Kids First Sports Center, but that speaks about Early Learning Center, as you know, is called the campus at Kids First. So we have an early learning center that is part of the Kids First Village, which is what, by the way, Wendy, what I'm referring to our 15 and a half acres now. That's the Kids First Village. And it's an early learning center. And that is an industry. Think childcare in a more euphemistic term, you might say daycare, right? Which we are not daycare. We're an educational institution. People use us for childcare during the day, but we are not daycare. We separate from daycare. But what this is a notoriously difficult industry with people who are notoriously unhappy with their product, with high turnover rates in the clients and in the employees. And our turnover rate approaches zero in both. And we won't talk about the employees because it's a whole nother subject, similar concept. But with our clients who don't like what we do and like what we stand, because we're better at communicating this, those who don't like our way of thinking about the world, we don't link up to begin with. So we just have virtually zero troublesome clients in an industry that is known for troublesome clients. Taking that to your industry, I don't know much about it, but I can guess. I can guess that you have in management of some of your operations, that there are some that are easy to deal with and some that are very difficult to deal with. And when you run against somebody who's very difficult to deal with, you really need, because those 2 percenters we're referring to them, they take, they're 2% of the population and it takes 80% of your time and energy.
Like the 80-20 rule.
So take a disproportionate amount of time and energy. And when you realize that you've got that kind of client that is taking that, and not just once because they've got a problem one time, I'm talking about this habitual person habitually is doesn't like your procedures, doesn't want something different, wants an exception. Think about cutting them loose. I remember you and I had a discussion probably now a couple of years ago about a particular client you had, and I remember suggesting you need to cut them loose. Do you remember this conversation?
Yeah, it was really difficult. And when you say habitual, that doesn't ring true so much with the guests, but with owners that you're working with and managing their properties, they are somebody that's around, not quote unquote around, like with you for the long haul. So that could be a habitual problem. From the beginning, it wasn't difficult for me to recognize this is not in alignment. And maybe I didn't share the expectations clearly from the beginning. And so as we've added more homes and more with newer owners, I have changed our processes to explain exactly what the expectations are for us, what the expectations are for them. The same thing has happened with guests. In the beginning, it was kind of like, yay, everyone, you know, everyone stay here. This is going to be great. And we quickly, and my sister, Ashley, who works with us, who has also heard about 2 percenters and all of these things, we have worked, we're changing our messaging all the time to set the expectations for the guests before they book. They have to clearly accept. We want to make sure that they read and are actually saying, yes, I read it, or yes, I understand, and we agree. That has alleviated so many issues. They know where we're coming from, what we're putting out there, and they know what they're getting. It's just helped so, so much to alleviate a lot of those problems. And even if there is still a communication issue, we pick up the phone right away and we communicate those behind the scenes things so they can understand. Like you're saying, like you're an open book. We are also the same way in our business. Hey, I totally understand that you want to get in early. Like we would love for you to get in early, but we just can't do that because we have XYZ happening at the house. We're preparing it for you. Can't drop off your bags because in the past we've had people fall asleep on the bed while the cleaners are trying to clean. So explaining these things, they're like, oh, totally get it. Okay. And it's really just alleviated so many issues. It's so important to get clear with what you're offering and the culture of your business and why you do things. And don't be afraid to explain it to people and in a clear way. And you can, like you said, maybe the outcome is not what they want, but they'll understand.
In your business, is the greater amount of energy spent on nurturing the users, your clients, which would be those who own the properties, or the end user would be the guests? Where's your challenge, your greatest challenge?
It would definitely be the guests because you don't spend that much time with each one of them, communicating with them.
And it's not a long-term relationship. It's a momentary relationship.
With the owner, it's a partnership. So there's, you know, it works over time. Whereas with the guests, it's a very small window.
There's an expression that we rely on back home or at Kids First. It probably applies more to the owners that you man, the properties you manage, and not the guests, but you get treated in life the way you teach people to treat you. And I'm going back, and you brought up some of the 2 percenters that you had to deal with. And I mentioned this because in following the thinking, you get treated in life the way you teach people to treat you. And if those of you are having problems with the properties that you manage, you might actually be encouraging them unknowingly and certainly unwittingly, but encouraging them to seek to take advantage of you simply by the way that you're dealing with them and the way you're talking with them. Going back, and I bring it up because I go back to examples in our operation where we have had 2 percenters that have taken that disproportionate. And these would be, if you will, parents of athletes who are the 2 percenters, and they take up a hugely disproportionate amount of time of your energy. As the owner at Kids First, you know, it was my job to help protect the coaches from those 2 percenters to the extent that I could. And so I remember numerous times, and I think with you getting involved in having meetings in that conference room and
even to the point where, you know, we talk it through and explain, you know, why, what we do, why we do it, and what we can do, what we can't do. And sometimes that would be enough of a solution. And in many instances, and I think with the one that I'm thinking of with you, was we got to the point with this particular 2%er where we sat in the room, we said, we have a real dilemma here. And you have a right to question your daughter's training, which is true. But at some point, a preponderance of questions shows a lack of support. And we now have got to that point where the coaches are feeling a lack of support, and that's a problem. And so here's our dilemma. We love having your child around, but you have taken up too much of our time and energy, and we no longer want to deal. We no longer can deal with you. So there, our dilemma is, we'd love to have your child continue to participate, but we cannot have you involved in the program. So our solution is, so would you choose, which is, you are welcome to drop your child off at the door, but you're not welcome then to come in and watch practice. And if that's not palatable to you, then we understand. Then we just won't be able to serve your child. And this lady said, okay, I accept that. And some done, some don't. You know, this is only happened.
The relationship was great after that.
And she became a model citizen. What you had done is, in some manner or another, because I wasn't the one dealing with it, you had taught her that it was okay to badger you with questions about the training, okay? Not knowingly, not intentionally, but you had taught her it was okay to do that. You say, well, I didn't want that. Well, somehow or another, you sent the message. It was okay until, at this point, I got involved, said, it's no longer okay. Here are the game. Here are the new rules. You know, you can be involved with these under these conditions. So this is not necessarily appropriate, but bottom line is, if those of you do have some tough customers, and I don't mean the end user, I'm not talking about the guest, take a look in a mirror and see if maybe you haven't allowed them to dictate to you, and then you bellyache about it, but it happens again, and then you bellyache about it, and it happened again. Well, wait a minute, at some point, your bellyaching is doing nothing than condoning their behavior. So be careful about that. Now, never forget that. You get treated in life the way you teach people to treat you. And I'm not talking about you got to be heavy-handed and you got to demand respect of somebody, because I'm not thinking that. I'm talking about the way you deal with people, the way you communicate, the firmness with which you communicate, the kindness with which you communicate. All that translates into, how do they treat you? So if you have problems with your guests, look at your systems and see if your systems might be condoning that or encouraging that. If you're having problems with your owners and houses you're managing, yeah, take a look at how you are dealing with them. Because if it's going on and on and on, you're participating in that, whether you know it or not.
Right. That's exactly what's happened in some cases in the past, where I will answer any of your questions. But at a point, I'm starting to think that you don't trust me or support us to take care of. And then maybe this, you taught me, it's okay to break up. It's okay to not have some, you don't have to keep all the clients. In fact, it's best to keep the ones that do support you and are in line with your mission. We kind of got off on the tangent from the private lending, but all business related. And I mean, honestly, that could have applied to your family member that you're working with too. So just make sure that there's that open communication. The expectations are set in the beginning and should be smooth sailing.
Yep. And I dedicated myself some years ago, and I can tell you it was around 19. So I'm talking about when I was about mid 40s, little early 40s, mid 40s, I came to the conclusion from the various circumstances in my life, and I was able to articulate to myself, I will never deal with a person that lacks integrity again. So I will never, I'm not saying I won't deal with them momentarily. If integrity is an issue with an individual, one of two things going to happen. They're going to leave, or I'm going to leave, depending on whatever the situation. If it happens to be an employee, it's them that's leaving. If it happens to be a relationship, it's me that's leaving. That was an event in my life in my mid 40s that I was able to say, I will never deal closely in a, you know, close relationship, partnership with anybody that, so as soon as I sense they lack integrity, I'm going to end that relationship in whatever way is appropriate. It's a wonderful way to go about your life. And that goes with, you know, with your clients.
Yeah. And it doesn't have to be an explosion. Say, this isn't working. And you can say it in a kind way, as we've mentioned too.
That's right. And it's pain. It can be painful. Some cases,
then it's over.
But you got to do it. You can't. It's over. And then you ask yourself, man, do I wish I'd done that sooner? And the answer is invariably, absolutely.
And what can I do to make it better for the next guest or the next owner or the next client? How can I relay my boundaries and that sort of thing beforehand?
We have our 7 hiring mantras. And the last of our hiring mantra is not a hiring mantra. And it goes like this. It goes, when you realize you've made a hiring mistake, and this applies to if you have a client, if you're managing a property, same concept. When you realize you've made a hiring mistake, act swiftly. And the good dose of courage is you got to remember that your job is to do the greatest good for the greatest number, because it's always tough to cut loose of a client or a relationship or an employee. There's pain involved in that, and people tend to avoid it and they procrastinate it because of the pain. So this mantra, this discipline, if you will, remember, okay, act swiftly and remember your job is to do the greatest good for the greatest number, which means that if it's your job to muster the courage to forge through the pain, because the pain is not just affecting you, it's affecting other people too. So you've got to take care of the greater good. And that means it's your job to accept that pain and get the job done and the relationship, dismiss the person, whatever the situation demands. Right. When you've got a life full of people that I deal with, in one sense of the word, the people I deal with, I don't need contract. That's how well I know them. And that's how much I trust them, and vice versa.
But you're still going to write them, even the family members.
You're still going to write. Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. Yeah. I don't recommend that. I don't recommend not writing them for reasons I already stated. Right.
Thank you for coming on and hashing this out. I'm glad that we got to talk about 2%ers again, because I was so curious how you felt about that 10 years later. Also, I hope everyone learned that it's okay to borrow money from your family. It's okay to lend to your family. Just do it in a very... just hash it out, all the details out beforehand.
If you're a modern owner, say, hey, I've got a project. I'd like to request a loan. And here's how much I'd like to request. Here's the terms. Here's what I'd like to offer to you. When you're borrowing money from a bank, your title page is request for financing. You ask for a certain amount. You tell for how long. Here's the interest rate that I'm going to pay you or whatever the terms will be. And here's my plan to see that this is, to see that this is actually going to happen, that I'm going to be able to follow through with that. And then when you approach it that way, and you have a business approach going into it, now the other party has got they've got the decision to say, that's a good business decision for me and a good risk for me or not. If you just say, can you loan me some money? Yeah, now nobody knows where to go with that. Know what you need, make your request for financing. Here's what I need. I need this amount. I need it for this length of time. Here's the terms, the interest rate or the partnership. And here's my plan for seeing that it's going to happen. It's called a business plan.
Still needed with a family member. All right. Thanks, Jeff. Thank you so much for coming on. I know that this is not your world, but I think that everyone's going to benefit from hearing about private lending and how to handle difficult clients. So thanks for coming on.
All right. Good luck to everybody. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Thanks for Visiting podcast. Head on over to the show notes for additional information about today's episode. And please hit that subscribe button and leave us a review. Awesome reviews help us bring you awesome content. Thanks for tuning in, and we look forward to hanging out with you next week. Wonder what it would be like to have personalized guidance from Annette and me? Imagine achieving the same incredible results we helped Amy achieve, increasing her overall revenue by a staggering 187% by diving into her biz numbers. Or perhaps you'd love to boost your hosting business like Miranda, who added a fantastic $10,000 by refining her pet policy. Well, here's a scoop. There's only one way to get that one-on-one support from Annette, myself, our expert coaches, and our industry pros, is by attending our on-demand workshop. Trust us, it's worth it. During the workshop, we'll make an offer to all of our attendees to join our membership. Once you're a part of our exclusive membership, you'll gain access to our elite community of hosts in our private Facebook group. This is where the magic truly happens. Members are engaging in discussions about their business numbers, occupancy rates, how to handle guest challenges, and providing unwavering support to one another. Plus, we will have live coaching calls to help you dive deeper into portfolio growth, team building, marketing, and so much more. Don't wait any longer. Head on over to www.hostmasterclass.com right now to secure your spot and embark on this exciting journey with us. That's www.hostmasterclass.com. Trust us, you won't regret it.